poured myself a stiff drink because I knew something had just happened. And it goes something like this: narrating trauma fragments how we remember. We recall what we can and what we desperately need to keep ourselves together. Wounds, historical and painfully present, threaten to rend the soul, and if that happens, nothing else matters. Telling the story of trauma in fits and starts isn't history in any formal sense. It is the way traumatic memory works, recollections caught in the pitch of battle between remembering and forgetting. That's Tony right there. Facts bungled on behalf of much needed truths. We try to keep our heads above water and tell ourselves a story that keeps our legs and arms moving below the surface. Terror cannot be remembered. One blots it out. The organism, the human being, blots it out. One invents or creates a personality or a persona beneath this accumulation rock of ages. Sleeps or hopes to sleep that terror which the memory repudiates. And then I said the cruel irony, of course, is that terror, the terrors move us about. We dig trenches to redirect the memories and to get them to flow away from us. But like the waters of the Mississippi River, the memories always return, flooding everything, no matter how high we build the stilts. Right. So I think at the end, Baldwin is trying to, in the latter part of his career, trying to tell the story of what happened. Right. And trying to offer a language that will allow us, right, to pick up the pieces and move forward. You cannot understand what Tony is doing with memory and Beloved and not understand what Baldwin is doing with memory and No Name in the Street. Structurally, it's almost right. They're echoing each other in these extraordinarily beautiful ways. Memory turning back on itself, anything triggering it. The mind is a strange thing. He was on the verge of madness in the face of it all.
Yes.
And you're going to dismiss that, Doc? You're going to dismiss that?
That's rich. But back to Maya's reading, though, at the very beginning of our dialogue, where right before you talk about beginning again, you were talking about what is not lost. And what is not lost is responsibility. Responding. An ability to respond. Accountability. Accounting of oneself. Accounting of one's community. Accounting of one's society and the world. Answerability. We have to be able to answer one another. And you see, this is, Baldwin gets this in Black music. You see that the musicians must take responsibility for the notes they play, right or wrong. Responsibility for the sound. Responsibility for the impact on the audience. Are you going to touch the souls of the folk to enable them in such a way that they can be agents of love and hope? And I think Baldwin understood, and Brother Eddie lays this out so magnificently, that the Black intellectual ought to be like the Black musician. See, when Black folks see the Black musician, they say, that's somebody who will more likely empower me if they sing it in the right key and know how to play. Whereas Black intellectuals don't have that status. Black intellectuals, oh no, here comes another arrogant so-and-so looking down on everyday people, thinking they better than, uppity, and so forth and so on. If the Black intellectuals had the same status as the Black musicians, they would be looking for us. Oh, we hungry for more narrative. We hungry for more poetry. We want Haki. We want Gwendolyn. We want the last poet. We want Gil Scott. We go on and on.
So let me make this argument that the poets are Black intellectuals.
That's true. But the gap, though, Sister Maya, between the intellectuals and the academy versus the musicians is still a gap there.
But the bridge, then, is the poets who are in the academy and moving with music.
Moving back and forth. No, I hear you.
I hear you.
You're listening to Cornel West and Eddie Glaude Jr. on James Baldwin's Legacy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For CDs of this program and Begin Again, the book on James Baldwin, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. We're offering free of charge MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program. Our website, alternativeradio.org.
I mean, Brother Eddie knows that, you know, part of my critique of Baldwin, because I'm always suspicious of any revival of these folks. You know, there's a lot of big revival Baldwin, you know what I mean? And we appreciate Baldwin is unbelievable. But my critique is that Baldwin doesn't linger with his critique of the worst of the black bourgeoisie. His critique of white liberals is devastating. His critique of black liberals, underdeveloped. It's there, but he doesn't really sustain it. It's not an E. Franklin Frazier indictment of the black bourgeoisie in 1955. And you see, in the Obama, post-Obama era that we live in, we've got to have a bold critique of the worst of the black bourgeoisie that has, in fact, too often turns its back to the black poor and black working class. Mm-hmm. Now, with the best of the black bourgeoisie, it's beautiful. But Baldwin tends to be reluctant, it seems to me. Is that fair or unfair? What you think, though, brother?
I think this is why we need to return to the evidence of things not seen.
The Atlanta situation.
Yeah, because I think this is precisely the moment that you're looking for.
Okay,
because what happens when white supremacy still obtains and black folk have power? What are we to make of Atlanta, this representation of the very class that you're talking about? Right, white supremacy. He makes that wonderful distinction between white people and people who happen to be white, which I love, right? Yeah. Trying to get us to pay attention to the ideology of whiteness. But the object of that critique is the way in which power functions and the way in which capitalism functions and what happens when we get access to it and white supremacy still obtains.
Because what happens is the black intelligentsia gets so disarmed in the age of Obama. So that we didn't have enough critical voices telling the truth about the connections to Wall Street and drones and empire and so forth. Everybody wanted to protect him. Well, black unity is a beautiful thing. Black solidarity is different. See, black solidarity means you put a primacy on the least of these. I go biblical. The poor, the working classes, the widows, the fatherless. Not just the highly successful ones who are doing well. They're not the measure of how black people are doing.
You are absolutely right.
You see what I mean?
So, you're right. Mm-hmm. I want to ask before we pivot, because we're about to move to this part where the questions come. In addition to people like Kianga Yamada Taylor, who did critique Obama, and who are critiquing.
Strong. She's still as strong as can be.
Isn't she?
At Princeton, too. What's going on at Princeton?
I'm wildly proud of her. But I want to ask one more question with this framework that Dr. West has provided to us before we transition to the questions from the audience. So can you speak to the possibility of genuinely multiracial democracy while capitalism persists?
You know, of course. I mean, we have to freedom dream, right? I think there's a possibility for a multiracial coalition to speak to the contradictions of capitalism in this moment. But as long as capitalism obtains, there's going to be the view that some people are disposable, it seems to me.
Works in tandem with white supremacy in that way.
Well, racial capitalism is what it is, right? And so part of, but that doesn't preclude, because if I understand the question, it doesn't preclude the possibility of multiracial coalition to actually strike the blow to what capitalism is all, because the contradictions are in full view. One of the interesting things about this current moment is that the last 40 to 50 years of Reaganism, right, it's being revealed to be bankrupt.
Right, that's right.
All of his contradictions are in full view. And so part of what we're seeing in the streets are, you know, young folk who've come of age in the age of catastrophe or accumulated grief and the like. You see folk protesting over police brutality and the like. You see a kind of solidarity and vulnerability that the pandemic has generated. But the idea underneath it all, or at least the judgment underneath it all, is that the country is broken, right? And that's why we see all of these different groups and coalitions out in the streets risking their lives, we must say, because they are risking their lives. So my short answer to the question is, yes, I believe that in the possibility of multiracial coalitions in the face of capital. Cornell, does that make sense?
Oh, no. Well, you got to have solidarity and coalitions based on deep integrity and willingness to fight for poor people, beginning with people of color, not just Black people. Original sin of America is not slavery, it's the treatment of indigenous people. America begins as an empire. It doesn't begin as a democratic experiment. A democratic experiment within the bowels of the empire itself, predicated on Black folks' labor and vicious hatred of Black people. But yes, we got to have multiracial coalitions. There's just no doubt about that. It just have to make sure all those coalitions have to be unapologetic about fighting white supremacy and male supremacy and transphobia and homophobia and so forth. Baldwin himself talked about the American style of socialism.
You got absolutely. Yankee.
Yankee Doodle, talking about Bobby Seale and the other. Absolutely, he began as a Trotskyite when he was young, very very much so. And empire. I mean, here, with Juma Baraka and Glenn Ford and all of our leftist folk, they keep the pressure on. America is an empire and a predatory capitalist civilization, and profoundly white supremacy at its core, profoundly male supremacists at its core, with its transphobia and homophobia. But within that same experiment, there have been freedom fighters and love warriors coming out of a variety of different traditions. We, you know, culturally and artistically have actually been in the vanguard of it.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Before we make this transition to audience questions, are there thoughts you want to share?
Sister Maya, let me say this before we turn to the questions. Doc talked about the love. This man has loved me to death. And without his love and example, none of this would be possible. He loved me into understanding that this country boy from Mississippi could say something in the world, gave me the authority to believe in myself and to understand that I had the capacity to think with anybody, to walk in any room, to be a free Black man, yes, and to understand what it means to walk in love. So he poured all his love in me, and I just want to give him all the glory. Not all the glory, because it goes to God, but all
the glory. It's just such a blessing to be part of a great tradition, knowing that you're holding up that blood-stained, tear-soaked banner in such a way that the self-examination goes hand in hand with the fortitude, the determination to keep on fighting, keep on swinging.
How do we deal with neoliberalism's patterns of commodifying, appropriating, and effectively manipulating radical discourses, practices, and emotions?
How can I put this? And this is going to sound a bit too abstract. How do we resist the way in which neoliberalism reduces us to being individuals in pursuit of our own self-interest, in competition and rivalry with other individuals in pursuit of their own self-interest? And because we're individuals in pursuit of our own self-interest and competition and rivalry are the basic values that define that, right? It eviscerates any notion of the public good. Right. This is why you got folk can't understand why they cannot wear masks. They have no conception of what a robust understanding of standing in relation with others in genuine community. Part of what we have to do, it seems to me, is to figure out how to build relationships with one another that in some ways hold off that model, that way of being in the world. Right. Build communities of love that allow you to laugh full belly laughs, to be rageful. Folk who will enable you to reach for a different way of being in the world, right? And I'm not trying to sound like Alistair MacIntyre, Doc, and talking about creating these little pockets where you can go off and run away from modernity. But I am saying that how we forge relationships with one another becomes an active political gesture in this moment, it seems to me. Does that make sense, Doc, or is that too?
Oh, absolutely. And the joy that you have in those relationships have to be deeper than the pleasure you get in other corners of the world, in other corners of the community. See, joy is something qualitatively different than pleasure. Black people traditionally have been a soulful people because we've been a joyful people. You can't be soulful if your whole life is just about pleasure. It has to cut at that deeper spiritual and moral level. And we have to be honest. We have to realize all of us, especially those of us in the Black middle class, are always already commodified in one way or another. And that has to be the object of our critical reflection. It's like Baldwin and No Name in the Street. He says, I know I'm the great white hope for the liberal establishment. I want to talk about that. I'm not going to be that hope for them. Now, that doesn't mean white folk. It doesn't mean he just kowtowing to Black folk. He got something inside of him that's called a calling, not just a career. He got something inside of him called a cause, not just a brand. And I need to say that now in a highly commodified culture. Everybody can't wait to have a brand. Can't wait to have their brand. They missing the point. That's a key sweat moment. Something just ain't right. something just ain't right. That's what Mama tells Walter in A Raisin in the Sun, right?
We
talk about freedom. Now all we talking about is money. And what did Jimmy say about Sweet Lorraine? Jimmy said she understood the difference between keeping the faith and making it. Everybody got in some sense make it because you got to have cash. You don't live by bread alone. You got to keep the faith. Whatever faith it is, you know, whatever faith it is, it's got to be a faith bigger than your ego, bigger than your narcissism, bigger than your career, bigger than your opportunism, bigger than your next PR move. You got to have something inside of you. And Brother Eddie Glaude, he got something inside of him that he had before I even set eyes on him.
In a moment where we are not safe with active close physical intimacy because of a pandemic. How do we build real closeness in a digital era? You know, when we're sort of trapped on platforms that are capitalist projects and that are fast forms of the kind of developed relationships or community-based ties that we would make in person otherwise?
That's a hard question, Maya. I'm thinking about Wilna Jumeist, Paul Taylor's wife. She lost her mama to COVID-19, and she couldn't go home to say goodbye to her. Couldn't send her home right because she was worried about coronavirus and her children. So there are ways in which this current pandemic has interrupted touch, has given grief a different sort of register. It gives it an edge because grief now comes with regret. And grief and regret is dangerous, right? Mama, I wish I could have said to you that I was sorry before you went away. I wish I could have resolved X, Y, and Z. And so that's happening alongside of the fact that we are sheltering in place, and many of us are, and we can't touch, we can't engage. But I think they're in the midst of this. So I'm trying to get to an answer to your question, is that in the midst of this, we have to find ways of being together. We're trying to figure out how to maintain each other's soul, how to be not a crutch, but a shoulder in the midst of this. You know? And so how are we going to be coming on the opposite end of this? You know, the way in which we're trying to continue community and stand in right relation with each other under these conditions, what it will look like when we get on the other side of this might just be even deeper, if that makes sense.
I certainly hope so. And I think that's a real possibility out of the project of making time for one another, which seems to be the core of your answer.
You remember that part two of Coltrane's Love Supreme's resolution?
That's right.
We've got to resolve ourselves, tied to the pursuance. Resolve ourselves. Nothing will get in the way of our love of each other. People whose child could have been born in Virginia and got sold to Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
Never forgot about that precious little Black baby. And as soon as you get free, if you got to walk from Virginia to Texas, you gonna get that precious little girl.
That's right.
Resolve that nothing will get in the way of the love that we have for the people.
You see? Mm-hmm. That's right.
And whatever it takes, we got to be improvisation, got to be flexible, prudent, protein, and so forth. But whatever it takes, and I think that's part, again, of the great tradition that we started this dialogue.
Absolutely.
Very much so.
I think it transitions into this question of how we raise our Black children. I haven't been a child for a long time, but I was raised by Black people who love Black people. who care for our souls and our intellects, and there is a question here about how we raise our Black children. So that's how I feel raising my Black children. How do we negotiate our own radicalized trauma while trying to give enough sunscreen for our children to not get burnt in the white streets?
Wow. Yeah. You know, there's this wonderful line and there's this wonderful moment in The Uses of the Blues where Jimmy rejects a certain description of the Negro problem, right? He says, I don't know what people mean by the Negro problem, right? But what we mean by the Negro problem is that we got to try to keep whatever this world is saying about our children from taking root in them. Trying to keep whatever the world is saying about them from taking root in their spirits, in their souls.
Yeah,
right? Those thousand cuts daily, right? But we have to be honest with ourselves. I have to be honest with myself that my own trauma, my own wounds showed up in how I tried to raise my baby. You know, there's generational baggage. You bring it to the moment. All, you know, you love the best way you can.
That's right.
As vulnerable and full of fault as it may be, you love the best way you can. And it seems to me that to fortify them in that love, that no, as crazy as he may be, as broken as he seems, that Negro loves me to death.
Yeah.
And if they can come out of there, because, you know, if they can come out of that with that sense of love, then they have the armor. Because that Black love is something else. They have the armor to deal with the world. But we got to keep it from, we got to keep the world from taking that. The detritus of the world from taking root, from settling in their spirits.
Yes.
And that's an ongoing battle. Does that make sense?
Oh, that's so powerful, though, brother. It's so true. You know, one of the great moments in The Fire Next Time is in the letter to the nephew.
Yeah.
When Baldwin says, don't be afraid. And Martin Luther King Jr. used to say what? I'd rather be dead than afraid. So I tell my son, my dear brother Cliff, and my sisters, and my daughter's 18, two little precious ones. I say, you are so precious and priceless that the world might not understand that, but don't you ever be afraid to take a stand for something right. Don't be afraid. Don't you ever sell out. Don't you ever cave in. Don't you ever give up.
Just really quickly, I know there's this line of going back to the letter to my nephew. And you, I just reached back and grabbed it. He said, to be loved, baby, hard and forever, to strengthen you against the loveless world.
Yeah.
That's what Setha says to Paul D. Either you love, right? Your love is too hard. No. Uh-huh. Then he says, remember that. I know how Black it looks today for you. It looked Black that day too. Yes, we were trembling. We have not stopped trembling yet. But if we had not loved each other, none of us would have survived. And now you must survive because we love you and for the sake of your children and your children's children. That's what we're talking about. Ooh, right?
That's what we're talking about. Keep in mind, this is not love of Blackness in the abstract. It's love of Black people individually. The ones who will cuss you out, the ones who will tell you off. They're worthy of being loved. You don't love them because you want them to love you back because there's no popularity contest. Okay. Every Black person who falls in deep, profound love of Black people has been partly crucified by Black people.
That's right.
Everyone.
That's right.
Malcolm to Martin to Marcus to Fannie Lou to Ella Baker to Harriet Tubman. But they kept loving anyway because their love was that thick kind of love. It wasn't this mamby-pamby quid pro quo. I help you, you help me. You love me, I love you. Can you imagine what our music would have sounded like if that's what they were saying about? Lord have mercy.
One more big question.
Sure.
What do you think Baldwin would have to offer Black liberation organizers who are facing a deeply militarized police department and a resurgence of proud white supremacist violence?
That's an interesting question. And I wouldn't dare try to suggest that I would be able to anticipate Baldwin's words in this moment. I would just, you know, direct you to the wreckage. To search within his corpus, because I think he has language for us to speak to the moment. And, you know, he said he, they asked him this question in Esquire in 1968. And he said, I know, they said, well, what would you say to the folk who are out in the street? He said, well, you know, I wouldn't tell them not to get their guns. I wouldn't tell them, and I paraphrase, I wouldn't tell them not to fight and to defend themselves. And I would say to them, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you're going to kill that white man, if you're going to blow his brains out, if you're going to shoot him, which it may come to, he said, don't hate him. Because the hatred will corrode the soul, you know? Because at the heart of Jimmy's project, it seems to me, is a moral concern about who do we take ourselves to be? Who do we aspire to be? How do we not allow the ugliness of the world to deform and disfigure the soul, right? As we engage in this arduous task of self-creation under these captive conditions. So what would he say? Fight to your last breath, because that's what he said. But do it in the name of love, not in the name of hate.
Oh, that's eloquence. That's wisdom speaking, my brother. That's wisdom speaking. And we could say, even though we should never speak for Brother Baldwin, that when he went to the heart of American apartheid, U.S. neo-slavery, terrorism and trauma, called Jim Crow and Jane Crow, that's what he was up against. He got off that plane and that bus, and he walked into this militarized zone, lynchings and various vicious attacks and what have you. And what he, first thing I think he accents is, how is it that Black folk are able to keep their souls intact? See, that's a moral and a spiritual question. They didn't have a lot of political power. They didn't have a lot of economic power. They had a richness. They had a depth. They had a tremendous breadth of something cultural and moral and spiritual that actually made them morally superior than the white supremacists. Not because they were born that way, because their tradition under tremendous blood, sweat, and tears had produced them in that way. And that blew his mind, because see, he used to Harlem. And you know, the Black version of urbanicity in Harlem is different than the Black version of rural Mississippi. We all New World Africans, but we got different circumstances. The speed of walking and a whole lot of other things was going on there, you see. And so it blew his mind to encounter such a great people spiritually and morally under those kind of militarized conditions. That's the standards we have to keep as we move into the 21st century. And it's a very difficult standard because we've experienced, you know, strong moral decline in Black America because of the commodification and commercialization that Maya was talking about, and because the white supremacy so easily gets inside of us that we don't extricate it, as it were. But as long as we try to de-niggerize ourselves in the name of love, where whiteness or white people are not the point of reference. If you so obsessed with hating white folk, they still your point of reference. You in a world of trouble. You still captive. You still trapped. You see. Now, if you're loving white folk and not loving Black folk, you sick. You pathological. It's true. And pathology, you know, is out there.
Real talk.
A number of different ways, you see. That's true. What it is to de-niggerize yourself. By means of SS2 tradition. That's what our churches ought to be doing. That's what our mosque ought to be doing. That's what our synagogues ought to be doing. That's what our poets at their height do. That's what our musicians at their height do. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Come get this love so you never get niggerized in such a way that you forget that you're part of a great tradition.
Yeah. And I hope that we'll see you at the next one.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Maya.
Love you, Doc. Thank you. And thank
brother,
you, Maya.
Brother Eddie. Woo. Lord have mercy. What a love warrior you are at the deepest level, man. And we're going to be faithful unto death. We made a covenant. We're going to go down swinging. We're going to go down. I'll go down before him, but I'll go down with a smile on my face because I know the tradition continue on.
I love you to death, brother. Oh, my God. Wonderful.
Love you to death, my brother.
That was Cornel West and Eddie Glaw Jr. on James Baldwin's Legacy. The moderator was Maya Marshall. Eddie Glaw Jr. is university professor at Princeton and author of Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and its Urgent Lessons for Today. Cornel West is professor of the practice of public philosophy at Harvard and the author of Race Matters and Black Prophetic Fire. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Eddie Glaude Jr. and Cornel West on James Baldwin's Legacy, and Eddie Glaude Jr.'s book on Baldwin, Begin Again, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. We are offering free of charge MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Haymarket Books. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with John Coltrane, A Love Supreme.
You know what? Grant and I and the rest of the Away With Words team have been sending out this podcast for 14 years now, and we still have so much more to talk about. We're just getting started. Your questions and stories are what keep this show going. We could never do it without you. We learn so much from you, and we're so grateful. We also depend on your financial support. Go to waywardradio.org/donate and help out the nonprofit that produces this show. Here's to lots more learning and laughter.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. I learned a handy new term the other day, the Abilene Paradox.
As in Abilene, Texas?
As in Abilene, Texas. There's a story behind it. It really happened. So picture this. It's a hot, dusty summer day in small town West Texas. And there's a married couple and their in-laws, and they're sitting out on a porch and they're running a fan and sipping lemonade, just trying to keep cool. And there's nothing really much to do except sit there and play a lazy game of dominoes, just wiping the sweat from your brow. And at some point, the father-in-law pipes up with, "Let's get in the car and go to Abilene and have dinner in the cafeteria." So it's 53 miles away. It's this hot, dusty afternoon in a car with no air conditioning. And the daughter chimes in, "Oh, it sounds like a great idea." She asks her husband what he thinks. Husband says, "Sounds good. I just hope your mother wants to go." The mother-in-law says, "Of course I want to go. I haven't been to Abilene in a long time." So they all pile into the car, and it's miserable. It's just awful. The whole trip, they're sweating. The cafeteria food is just dreadful. There's a thin film of dust over everything. And 4 hours later, they're back on that porch. They're hot and exhausted, sitting in front of the fan trying to keep cool. And after a long silence, the son-in-law is trying to be sociable. So he pipes up with, "That was a great trip, wasn't it?" And the mother-in-law says, well, I just went along because the three of you were so enthusiastic. And it turns out nobody wanted to go to Abilene, but the guy... And then the guy who suggested it in the first place says, I never wanted to go. I just thought you might be bored.
Been there.
Exactly. And now there's a term for it because the son-in-law was Jerry B. Harvey, who was a professor of management science at George Washington University. And in 1974, he coined the term Abilene paradox to describe that phenomenon where a group makes a collective decision that's counter to the thoughts and feelings of all the individual members because everybody thinks their own preferences are the ones that nobody else has. So it stems from this breakdown of communication where no one wants to rock the boat. And it's something that in business school now they teach you to watch out for. I really appreciate having a term for that, the Abilene paradox.
Yeah, me too.
I had that happen to me recently.
Yeah, a group full of people are being so polite. Maybe you don't know each other very well, or you're all a little passive aggressive, or you don't really care all that much. It's just when you all finally get to the old buffet place, you're like, yeah, no, the mushy peas weren't what I had in mind.
Yeah, I didn't want to go. I just went along with you guys.
I'd have been happy with the sandwich and a little bit of Netflix. Thanks. Oh, well, from Abilene to Augusta, give us a call, 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Julie from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Julie.
Hi. So glad to be talking to you guys.
It's great to be talking with you as well. What's on your mind today?
So the other day, I was doing a crossword puzzle, and the solution for this one line I knew should be toe the line, and I was spelling it T-O-W, and it kept telling me that was wrong. It was a digital crossword puzzle. So it turned out it was supposed to be T-O-E. So then I went into my office, and I asked my coworkers, you know, the expression toe the line, how do you spell toe? And everybody except for this one young lady, Devin, said T-O-W, toe the line. And she said T-O-E. So we debated about it, and we had different meanings of it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The ones of us who said T-O-W said, you know, like carry your own weight, do what you're expected kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll let Devin explain what she thought the T-O-E was.
Okay.
Hi. So my name's Devin, also from Memphis, Tennessee. So like she said, I was the only one in our room and in my family who thought it was T-O-E. And in my head, it was kind of you were doing something that you know you knew could get you in trouble, but you were just enough behind the line or on it that you couldn't technically get in trouble for it. Basically, like just using a loophole to get around a rule without actually breaking the rule. So that's why I was always thinking it was toe the line, because in my head, it was like the mental image of you were putting the toe on the line, but not crossing it.
Uh-huh.
So when I asked my family about that, my mom said the same thing of, you know, it's you're pulling your own weight, doing this, that, the other. My dad actually used to work on a ship, so he said he's heard it both ways. But his was also because you put your foot on the line for a race. Specifically, you put the big toe of your left foot on the starting line, which is where the phrase, when we looked it up, it said that it originally started, and then it evolved into something along the lines of you stay within the boundaries.
Oh, my goodness. There's so much to unpack here.
Right. But it sounds like Julie and Devin represent both sides of this, because a lot of people do think it's T-O-W, toe the line, and the original was T-O-E, toe the line.
It was indeed, yeah. Back in the 19th century, we see the expression to toe the line, and we know that that's the original one because there were also other versions of this, like toe the mark or toe the scratch or toe the crack. And the idea was, as you suggested, Devin, getting up right to that line. And it wasn't so much being sneaky, but rather being obedient. You know, you want to think of military personnel all lined up in a very disciplined way where they're all towing the line. They're completely aligned with no deviation whatsoever. So if you're towing the line, the original sense was that you were conforming to whatever the standard was. So the traditional version, as you suggest, is TOE. You get your toe right into that line.
But there is a version with the TOW?
Well, you're I mean, if you want to be strictly correct about it, you're going to spell it TOE. But boy, that's
and it
that's
means
really
staying
something.
Within standard. Not carry your own weight.
Yes, it has nothing to do with towing or pulling something with a rope. You're measuring up to what the standard is, as you suggested.
Yeah, you're behaving. That's you're following funny. The rules. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So our anomaly was the correct one.
That's what happens when stuff is passed from ear to mouth and doesn't show up on paper all that often. We interpret it like we wish, and we develop mental images that can be really wrong. And it's not helped by the fact that many of the early uses of this and the variants like toe the mark and toe the scratch were in connection with the British Navy, which had, of course, lots of ropes that had to be towed or lots of lines that had to be towed. So it can be confusing. So it's completely forgivable to think that it was TOW and no harm done.
Julie and Devin, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Devin. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi. This is Jim Markley from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I'm tickled to be on the show.
Well, hi, Jim, from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Welcome to the show. Glad to talk to you.
Hi, Jim.
Thanks.
What's up?
Hi. Well, I have a question about counting time. When I was a kid, we would play touch football, and the rule was that you couldn't rush until 3 seconds had passed. So we would always say out loud, Mississippi 1, Mississippi 2, Mississippi 3, and then we would rush. Were we the only ones that ever did that? Is that everyone all over the country do that, every kid? And do they still do it? And do they say other things besides Mississippi?
And you would say Mississippi 1, huh?
Instead of putting the number before?
Yep, we always said Mississippi 1.
How interesting. I grew up using the word Mississippi, but I would say 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi. And I think that the first time I heard it used that way, it was counting the seconds between a flash of lightning and the sound of thunder. And it was Did you do it that way too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, or maybe playing hide and seek or something like that. The Mississippi 1 version is a new one on me, but there are lots of different ways in this country to say that. I know some people just say 1001, 1002.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough, across the pond in Britain, a lot of people, a lot of times people tend to say Piccadilly 1, Piccadilly 2. And it's just a delightful rhythmic way, I think, of counting time.
Do the Spaniards say one Barcelona?
I don't have information on the Spanish, but let's see. What do we know? The French sometimes count crocodiles, and actually they do sometimes say Mississippi. English speakers, including in the U.S. and other English-speaking countries, also will use, they have a whole menagerie. They'll hippopotamus, chimpanzee, crocodile, alligator, elephant. Elephant's very common in the U.K. The Polish use elephants as well. The Swedes tend to say 1001, or their version of 1001 in Swedish. 1001 is also used in the U.S. Let's see.
There are lots of different ways to do this. In German, it's interesting because they just use the numbers for 21, 22, 23, 21, 22. And one that I really love, I've been told that in the Romani language, which is spoken by about 3 million people, you learn it as something that translates as I am singing. Yek gilevava, dui gilevava, trin. I'm probably mangling the language there, but this is what I've been told, which I think is really lovely. I am singing.
Oh, Martha, yeah, the German one, the 21, 22, 23, the Danish, mm-hmm. The Dutch and mm-hmm. and the yep. Hebrew speakers do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Danish also do crates or cases of beer. One yep. case of beer, two cases of beer.
Yeah. Sort of the
three bottles of beer on the wall.
I was going to say the backwards version of that.
Well, this is great. I had no idea there were so many versions of it.
Ton of this stuff. I'm sure there's so many countries and languages that we haven't named, and we have so many listeners around the world who speak so many languages. If they've got contributions on how to, you know, approximately count off the sentences, we'd love to hear about them. So, Jim, if we come up with some more, we'll share them on the show.
That's great. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Our
hey,
pleasure.
Thanks for bringing back those memories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
How do you approximately count off the seconds in the languages that you speak? Please tell us, 877-929-9673, email words@waywardradio.org, or tell us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Support for Away with Words comes from a gift honoring students of the San Diego Community College District. City College, Mesa College, Miramar College, and continuing education prepare them for jobs, personal goals, and transfer to universities. sdccd.edu.
Your donations to this show help cover engineering costs, podcast and broadcast distribution, and more. Go to waywardradio.org/donate to help Away with Words today. Thank you.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett, and we're joined by that hilarious fellow, our quiz guy, the master of trivia, John Chinesky. Hi, John.
Hey, Grant. Hi, Martha. How are you guys?
Hey, John.
I have, I've got this new attitude these days. It's sort of like, whatever. You know the phrase, haters gonna hate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
To wit, don't get stressed over those who give you grief. They're the type of people who give grief in any situation. You know those teens down at the mall parking lot? The ones speeding around on their decks and pulling ollies and nollies and outside front 80s, you know?
Skater's going to skate.
Skater's going to skate, man. Yeah, exactly. Now, here are a few more instances in which people or things just do what they're going to do. Now, I know you have a crush on that handsome guy down at the Olive Garden, but you can't just request to be seated in his section and then try to flirt with him all night. You know what they say.
Oh, boy. The
what
hot guy at Olive Garden.
Now, you can't just request to be seated in his section and then try to flirt with him all night.
Waiter's going to wait?
Yeah, man. Waiter's going to wait. They're just going to wait. Yeah.
Hopefully I see. They're all rhyming with hate. Is that it?
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Got it. Oh, ouch. If you are a waiter down at the Olive Garden and someone wants cheese on their fettuccine, you have to be really careful with that metal thingy. You know, you could hurt yourself. You know what they say.
Grater's going to grate.
Grater's going to grate.
And scraper's going to scrape.
But then sometimes things do something you don't necessarily expect them to do. For example, I say, when I returned to my family's estate from university, I was quite surprised at how good my parents had gotten at chess. Well, you know what they say.
Mater's gonna mate.
Mater's gonna mate. She's so good.
Oh, I love the layers in that.
Thank you, yes. When that huge meteorite hit the moon, guess what we found in the center of that huge depression? A wooden box. No surprise.
Crater's gonna crate.
Crater's gonna crate. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
I don't know why that's funny, because it's so ridiculous.
It's just funny. It doesn't make any sense. But it doesn't make any sense, but it's true. It's very true. Here we go. Benedict Arnold. He did that thing I guess he's genetically predisposed to do. Well, you know what they say.
Traitor's gonna trait?
Trait, yeah. Traitor's gonna trait. Now, this one's sort of a conceptual one. It divides the earth into northern and southern halves, but even though those halves are not quite the same, somehow it makes it work. You know what they say.
Equator's gonna equate.
Equator's gonna equate, yeah, somehow. Finally, fans of Star Wars know that Darth Maul and Darth Sidious can tell you that the Sith, formerly known as Anakin Skywalker, will do what he do. You know what they say.
Vader's gonna vade.
Vader's gonna vade. I guess it's a thing.
Vader's gonna evade. I don't know.
Of course. Now, of course, if you didn't like this puzzle, hey, again, haters gonna hate. But I thought it went pretty well. You guys are great. Congratulations.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, guys. Talk to you next time.
John's got all kinds of trivia for us, and we think you have all kinds of language questions for us. Send us your thoughts and ideas to words@waywardradio.org, and you can call us toll-free in the United States and Canada, 1-877-929-9673. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Erica, and I'm calling from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi, Erica. Welcome to the show.
What can we do for you, Erica?
So I had a question that's not necessarily about a word or phrase, but it's about a sound that people make when they're waiting, passing the time. And usually it's like waiting on a phone call or just waiting for to get handed something. It usually sounds something like this, like. And everybody kind of makes it when they're just waiting around.
It's like your own personal Muzak.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, like your own personal music, yes.
Well done.
So I wanted to know why people do that, because it seems like everybody kind of does it. And what's it called?
I guess my first question for you is this for somebody else's benefit, or might you do it when you're by yourself?
I would say you do it more for yourself, kind of just kind of passing time. It's not really to entertain or anything. It's just something you do.
The reason I ask is because back when I was doing a lot of magazine articles and I would call experts for this or that and they would have to look something up, I was so struck by the fact that there was this period of time a few years ago when it seemed like everybody would be looking something up while they're on the phone with me, and they would say, do, 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 or something like that. Do you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It happens so often that I wanted to write a magazine article about that, but I couldn't really quite figure out how to do it. But I think that that happens as well when you call customer service or something like that. And I think that that sort of version of it communicates a certain amount of meaning. Don't you think? It's like I'm, you know, you're trying to maintain contact with the
I'm
person.
I'm here. Hang on. I haven't forgotten you.
Right. Do, do, do. Gosh, Grant, I mean, it's a kind. Yeah, right? Is that self-soothing? I don't.
Yeah,
I don't
it kind
know.
Of is, right? Isn't it? It's kind of, I don't know. It reminds me of the tuneless humming that people do sometimes. And you just catch them. They're on their own. And they're just like, it's not a song. It's not a tune. It's just, it's not words.
Yeah, it's definitely another version.
Hmm. Yeah.
Do you know what it's called?
No. Well, there is a category of language called phatic communication, phatic. And this is language we use for the general purposes of social interaction. This is what Martha was talking about, where instead of conveying information or asking questions, it's just we throw it in there in order to keep the social graces, in order to lubricate the relationship, so to speak, in order to like just make sure everything is copacetic, you know? And this, if there are other people involved, might be part of that. But I don't know if you're on your own, if that still qualifies as phatic communication, phatic. I don't know. You know, and it's funny, as we talk about this, I'm thinking about a couple of things. How is it that when you're in a group of people and, you know, everybody has to say, take a moment to privately write an answer on a card that will be submitted, everyone automatically does the Jeopardy theme. And those of you listening in the UK, do you guys do the theme from Countdown, which is a game show in the UK? Like, I don't know. And it also reminds me if you remember Sesame Street, and I don't know if they still have this, but there was this typewriter guy from Sesame Street. It's a typewriter on wheels with eyes and hands, and he comes from the distance and approaches the viewer, and he goes, no, 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 no.
Yes.
And then he eventually types one key and says that letter. What you're doing, Erica, reminds me of him. No, 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 no.
It could sound like that sometimes, yeah.
I don't know that there's a name for it, but boy, I've got to dig into this and find out more. Oh, this is a good one, Erica. This is a first. I don't think we've ever had this question before.
Yay! I'm a big fan, so I'm glad I brought something new around.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate it. Take care and be well, all right?
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, and in the voicemail, what's the waiting sound that you make? 877-929-9673.
Grant, you remember our conversation about indefinite hyperbolic numerals?
Yeah, umpteen, zillion, 50-11.
Mm-hmm. It turns out that there was a similar term in ancient Greek. It was samakosioi, which translates literally as sand hundred. It was coined by Aristophanes and used by several writers in ancient Greek. And I really like that, sand hundred. You know, it's just a vague number that is analogous to the number of grains of sand on the beach.
Oh, I like that too, sand hundred, because mm-hmm. who's going to count? I'll just take your word for it. That's how much sand is there.
Exactly. I told you sand 100 times to do that thing.
877-929-9673 or share your indefinite hyperbolic numerals on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Jessica. I'm calling from Carmel, Indiana.
Hi, Jessica.
How are you doing?
All right.
Doing well.
What can we do for you?
So you were talking about terms that are used like in your industry. In my industry in software development, there's this term rubber duck that you use for like if you're trying to debug a problem that you have and you're explaining what the problem is, then you realize what the answer is yourself without the person you're talking to having had to give you any input. So it's the idea is kind of like you might as well have been explaining it to a rubber duck. Mm-hmm. But in my office, we always use the term cardboard dog for that instead of rubber duck. So you might have the scenario where you're trying to debug something, you call somebody over to help you, and then you realize the problem yourself, and you might say, hey, thanks for being my cardboard dog, or they'll say, like, oh, glad I could be your cardboard dog. And I have never heard that outside of my own office, so I wasn't sure if that's, like, a common thing in the industry or if that's just something you know, one person came up with, and it's carried through just for us.
Yeah, what a handy strategy, right? I love the idea of rubber duck debugging, where you just pretend like you're explaining the problem to somebody else, like a rubber duck in your hand. Apparently, this goes back to a book published in 1999 called The Pragmatic Programmer by Andrew Hunt and David Thomas. That had a story about a programmer who kept a rubber duck handy and would just force themselves to explain the problem line by line to that little rubber duck. And you can sometimes work out a problem that way if you're simplifying it for somebody else, right? You're thinking through it yeah. aloud. And I think, you know, whether you're a computer programmer or just trying to write something and you can't quite express yourself, it's a great exercise to just go to somebody or, you know, I mean, I used to love as a journalist saying, explain it to me like I'm in eighth grade or something like that. Or, you know, explain mm-hmm. it to me like I'm 5 years old. And that's all kind of a piece with rubber duck debugging. But cardboard dog is an interesting one, too.
Yeah, and we know a little bit about its history. If you Google it, you might come across the site of Stephen Baker, and he has a story about a cardboard cutout dog. And he goes on to tell this pretty fanciful story about Jake the Yellow Labrador, who, in exchange for dog biscuits and scratches behind the ear, would listen to walkthroughs of computer problems, unlike Tinkerbell the cat, who would not listen, and managers and consultants and engineers cost money. But Jake, who had a great attention span, wouldn't get distracted and had a $0 hourly rate. But supposedly, Jake passed on while listening to a particularly thorny software problem, so they replaced him with the cardboard cutout dog. And anyway, I reached out to Stephen Baker and asked him about the story, and he says while the story is mostly made up, he does believe that he coined the term cardboard cutout dog, and it comes from some joke that he used to tell back in the old days of Usenet. If you remember, this was discussion on the internet before there was even a web. I've looked for it on Usenet. There are archives on Google Groups, and I haven't been able to find it. So it's at least as old as 2003 when he posted this story to his website, but probably he says it's probably older than that. So Stephen Baker of Texas probably was the coiner for this. So far, there are no other claimants.
That's fascinating. I didn't realize you'd be able to even find that it came from like one person.
Well, this is the nice thing about the computer world is the it's not so old that we can't still reach out to some of the long beards, you know, and the Unix heads and get their stories.
So I guess it is not just our office then. It's anybody who happened to read this person's website, probably.
Yeah, it got passed around a lot, and you'll find it. And even I think it's actually linked as a footnote on the Rubber Duck Programming Wikipedia page.
Next time I'll remember to check the footnotes. Thank you.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for this question. I just love the concept.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Take care. Be well.
Have a good day. Bye.
You too. We'd love to hear about your workplace jargon. Call us 877-929-9673 or send it to us in email. The address is words@waywardradio.org. Hey there, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Josh. I'm calling from Binghamton, New York.
Well, hello, Josh.
Yeah, I had a question. So growing up, we had a whole bunch of sayings. I was from Western New York, and one of them being beefed it. We usually used it in terms of when someone fell, like slipped and fall, they would say, oh, they beefed it. So I was wondering if that was specific to Western New York or if that's used more broadly, because I haven't heard it since I've moved and all my friends haven't heard of it before. So I'm beefed it. Where does that come from?
All right. Yeah, we can help you with that. About when would that be that you would have used that?
When I was growing up, so high school, like 2010, around then.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you say is beefed it. This is maybe B-E-E-F-E-D, like meat beef, right?
Yeah, like meat beefed it.
Okay. But you know what I think? I think this is connected to a slang term that is more widespread, to biff it, B-I-F-F. And the reason I think is it's exactly the same meaning, and it's used in like surfing and snowboarding and mountain biking. And I even find it glossed, that means like used as a equivalent, in a small dictionary of snowboarding slang where beef is also said to be another word for biff, and they call it a wipeout. And so it looks like biff and beef are the same. Sometimes it's spelled B-I-F. So sometimes it could just mean to fail or do badly, and that is how I first encountered it in the early to mid-1980s, where it shows up in campus slang with a sense of failing an exam. And also it shows up about the same time as a sense of being clumsy. Somebody who's beefed it is somebody who has fallen down. Maybe they tripped and dropped their books. And not long after, it shows up in surfing to mean, you know, getting smacked by a wave, or snowboarding to be wiped out, or mountain biking, you have a crash. So it's biff is this use that we see more commonly, B-I-F-F. Again and again and again, and it pops up in casual text, it pops up in these like amateur dictionaries, and it pops up in these professional dictionaries as well, early 1980s and onward.
Interesting. Yeah, just thinking, we do have there's like a small skiing hill, snowboarding hill in the area, you know, drive a couple hours, but not like we have a really profound culture around snowboarding, so that's, I can see that changing from biff to beefed.
There's also a biff in baseball, which means to hit a ball hard, which is way older than that. And also to biff something, just to hit it in general, is way older, like by 100 years. So we've long had in slangy English this sense of to biff, meaning to hit, or to hit something hard or to punch it, long before this sense of to biff something, meaning to fall or to crash or to fail, to wipe out, to fall down. So it's possible that there's a relationship there, but it's hard to know because there's a little bit of onomatopoeia happening here, right? Biff kind of sounds like what happens when you fall, particularly on snow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Josh, I hope this was enough information to make you feel like we connected with your past, with your memories.
Oh, yeah, more than plenty. I really wasn't sure of the whole history there, but it's pretty plentiful. Thanks a lot.
Outstanding. Thank you for calling, Josh.
Thanks, bud. Take care. Be well.
Yeah, have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 877-929-9673. More about what we say and why we say it. Stick around for more.
Support for Away With Words comes from Jack and Caroline Raymond, proud sponsors of Wayward Inc., the nonprofit that produces and distributes this program. You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language.
The left is mirroring that which it wants to defeat and criticize in its form of organization. What we should really do on the left is smash the mirror. Imagine things are not just simply like neoliberalism with a left tilt. We have to think about something which is kind of, you know, radically, radically different. And this is a moment when I think some of that imagination can occur.
That's David Harvey, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David Harvey, Smash the Mirror, Imagining a Different System. The global health and economic crises are points of opportunity. Arundhati Roy, the great Indian intellectual and writer, says, "Whatever it is, coronavirus has made the mighty kneel and brought the world to a halt like nothing else could. And in the midst of this terrible despair, it offers us a chance to rethink the doomsday machine we have built for ourselves. Nothing could be worse than a return to normality. Historically, pandemics have forced humans to break with the past and imagine their world anew. This one is no different. It is a portal, a gateway between one world and the next. We can choose to walk through it, dragging the carcasses of our prejudice and hatred, our avarice, our data banks and dead ideas, our dead rivers and smoky skies behind us. Or we can walk through lightly, with little luggage, ready to imagine another world, and ready to fight for it." The words of Arundhati Roy. Our guest today is David Harvey. He's a distinguished professor of anthropology and geography at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of many books, including The Anti-Capitalist Chronicles. This webinar, organized by Haymarket Books, was recorded in mid-November. The moderator was Umba Akbar, law professor at The Ohio State University. And now, David Harvey.
I think it's very important to try to separate out what was there already and what the virus has done. I mean, there are certain specific things, obviously, that come from the impact of the virus. And it may be that the virus has done us a favor in the sense that it stripped bare a lot of the bankruptcy of the neoliberal kind of governmental project, which is essentially to take the government out of the support of the population, to privatize social welfare through the NGOs and all the rest of it, and essentially to not prepare to protect the whole population. That project has been going on for a very long time. It is not about getting government out of the economy. In fact, the government in many ways is back into, always has been back into the economy in big ways, in cahoots usually with big capital. One of the symbolic sides of that is that nearly always the Secretary of the Treasury in the United States has come from Goldman Sachs, and that's been the case since the 1990s. And in a sense, the whole kind of economy has been managed in public-private partnerships, which is the general strategy of which is that the private takes the profit and the public bears the risk. But now the bankruptcy of that, I think, is being revealed pretty much everywhere through the impact of the virus, and something has to be done clearly in terms of restructuring the positionality of the state in relationship to the economy. The ruling class, I think they see this as a point where probably they have to, for a variety of reasons, launch into a strategy of reform. And actually, in U.S. history, and if we just confine ourselves to the United States, there have been these quite dramatic reform periods, like the New Deal, like the Progressive Era, like the sort of 1960s. And I think that people see, for two reasons, that they need to